Today is Thursday, September 24th, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, anger and mourning after no police officers are charged in the killing of a black woman.
We could be sleeping in our own bed, murdered, and ain't nothing done about it.
Also ahead, Hong Kong police arrest pro-democracy leader Joshua Wong.
And it's time to urge the government stop the political prosecution. Chilling effect is not the way out, and it will not cause us to surrender.
Plus, reaction to the European Union's proposed migration policy. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Louisville in the U.S. state of Kentucky. Police arrested nearly 100 people in Louisville Wednesday night in a crackdown on protests against a grand jury's decision to not indict three white police officers in the fatal shooting of black woman Breonna Taylor in March. The three officers, Brett Hankison, Jonathan Mattingly, and Miles Cosgrove, killed Taylor in her sleep when they burst into her apartment to serve a search warrant and fired their weapons. Taylor's boyfriend shot at them and says he thought there was a break-in, but Kentucky Attorney General Daniel Cameron said his investigation showed the officers acted in self-defense. Two police officers were shot and wounded during the protests and are expected to recover. Police say a suspect is in custody.
Officer down. Yes.
Justice for Taylor, along with George Floyd, who died in police custody in Minnesota in May, has been a key demand of the massive protests that have rocked the U.S. this summer. In Louisville, police wearing riot gear deployed Wednesday in military-style vehicles, the AP reports. They fired pepper balls and flashbang grenades and drew long guns. Protests also took place in Portland, Oregon, New York City, and elsewhere. In Atlanta, Georgia, police said they sprayed chemical agents at protesters, the AP said. In Washington, D.C., a series of black women addressed a crowd that gathered at the Black Lives Matter Plaza outside the White House.
To be a black woman in America, it requires so much labor to exist. So much labor to just wake up in the morning and put on our clothes and go out in the day and face the world. We are the people who hold our communities together. We hold our communities together, but who is there to hold us? We could be sleeping in our own bed, murdered. And ain't nothing done about it.
For black women, this isn't news. For black people, this has never been news. And we have been the backbone of every single social movement in this country. Black women. And we have fought for every group of people. We fought for white women when y'all didn't even fight for us. But we are left disrespected, unprotected, and brutalized in the very nation that we built off our backs. And you know, it's difficult being this angry all the time. Black women shouldn't know anger like this. Anger shouldn't be as easy as breathing for black women, but we have to be. Because if we're not angry, nobody's angry for us.
Yes. Protests are set to continue over the weekend, demanding justice for Breonna Taylor. The violence in Louisville on Wednesday is just the latest in a string of incidents as the U.S. heads toward an election amid mass protests. For analysis of the situation, I spoke to Brian Kastner in Buffalo, New York. Kastner investigates human rights abuses, weapons, and armed groups with Amnesty International.
So after the Breonna Taylor indictment or non-indictment from the grand jury, we saw protests not just in Louisville, but all over the country. And those protests, some of them were peaceful, some of them became violent. There's a number of groups that are on the street at the same time, and that makes the situation, not just in Louisville, but in other cities, very confusing. There are right-wing militias that are armed with long guns. There are left-wing groups that have pledged violence. There are protesters who are demonstrating their right to peaceful protest, as they should. And all those things are happening at the same time, which makes it very confusing.
Two police officers were shot and wounded in Louisville. Can you talk about this shooting in the context of other shootings that have taken place of police this year?
Right. So when there's a shooting at a protest, it's no longer a protest. There is no place for that. And this is why we at Amnesty are very clear that there's also no place for firearms and long guns at a protest. That is not a tool of peaceful protest, and no protesters should be showing up with weapons of that kind. It's just no place for it, no matter what group they happen to be associated with. So it is, when I say that it's confusing, we don't know who did the shooting. In previous cases, earlier this year, it was a right-wing member of the Boogaloo that shot a police officer. In other cases, there have been left-wing groups that have shot at police. It could be either. We simply don't know what happened, and so we want to wait for more facts to come out before we as a public should make any broad declarations of what happened last night.
Now, before the protests even began on Wednesday in Louisville, there was a state of emergency issued, huge deployments of police. How do you assess how the police responded to these protests?
That's right. So there was the state of emergency. There was a 9 p.m. curfew instituted before protests even began. And then a unlawful assembly was declared and people were arrested and taken off the streets and pushed out long before that 9 p.m. curfew. The law is very clear on this. People have a right to peaceful protest. They have a right to freedom of assembly. That right does not get dismissed at an arbitrary curfew time. And as we have seen all over the United States, when the police show up to fight, they're liable to get one. So just by setting a tone of declaring a state of emergency long before there was any decision put out or any protesters on the streets, I think that sets the tone for how, you know, all these protests are going to go, and it shouldn't then be surprising when it turns into confrontations. They should be thinking about this problem of policing protests in completely the opposite way. It is not for them to set up police lines, riot gear, et cetera, going in for a fight. They should be looking at how to facilitate and allow and ensure that people have the right to peaceful protest.
As the U.S. continues toward the election, what are your concerns?
My concern is that the United States is heading in a trajectory and in a direction that it really doesn't understand. And when you look at other cases in other countries, when armed groups and violent non-state actors get on the street supporting one political party or another or political movement or another, the violence that comes is just, it is not the direction the United States wants to go. Our concern looking at, say, what's happened in Kenosha is that when armed groups do go on the street, that sometimes the police welcome them and welcome them as assistants. And it's not, the police should be applying the law equally and should be applying curfews equally. And they're there to facilitate everyone's safety and not to take sides among the various armed groups. They're there to protect the safety of society and civil society in general. So the United States is potentially headed in a dangerous direction, and that's what we're monitoring right now.
That was Brian Kastner, who investigates human rights abuses, weapons, and arms groups with Amnesty International. As the U.S. election season heats up, so has rhetoric against journalists. For more on the climate for press in the U.S., I spoke to Nora Benavidez. She is director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at the press freedom organization PEN America in New York.
You know, I think it's necessary to understand the backdrop recently over the last several years in which we have seen a kind of downgrading of press freedom here in the United States. in which leaders here denigrate the press, do what they can to limit access to reporters, to be able to cover what's happening at places like our White House, at state capitals. And now, over the last several months, we have seen efforts to limit press coverage of protests here in the United States. And all of that, I think, happens against a political rhetoric backdrop in which leaders are calling out reporters. The most obvious example is this recent one in which President Trump applauded an attack on a reporter who was covering a protest, saying that watching that attack was a beautiful sight.
And what does this indicate about press freedom or safety for journalists more broadly in the U.S.?
Frankly, we've seen him display these similar kinds of attitudes and use similar rhetoric throughout his tenure as president. Since he came into office in 2017, PEN America has witnessed a slow kind of stepping away from holding dear the principles of the First Amendment and a free press, much of that because of President Trump's words and actions. First, we have seen him exhibit interest in removing journalists, for example, from press briefings when he doesn't like them or he doesn't like their questions or the way that they report or even the outlet that they work with, which frankly, you know, limits our free press, but it also limits the ability of the public to really know what's happening inside and around the White House. We've also then see him, you know, just display and kind of use rhetoric that is incredibly troubling. He refers to reporters when he doesn't like them on his Twitter account, calling them out explicitly, denigrating them, putting them down.
Now, is this just one figure of Donald Trump doing this, or is this coming from other politicians as well?
Part of what, you know, PEN America does is we try to defend press freedom across all political aisles. And, you know, in just a few short years, the political landscape has really changed here in the U.S. when it comes to journalist safety. We have seen physical threats towards journalists. Of course, we've seen the fatal shooting at the Capital News Gazette in Maryland. We've then seen just the general decimation of local newsrooms in their suffering from lack of financial support. And against all of that, there are attacks on journalists, both online and in person, at the local, state, and federal level. And throughout all of this, you know, we're dealing over the last few months with these protests here in the U.S., and we have seen over 500 attacks since June on reporters who are trying to cover those protests around the United States. Various reporters who then try to shine a light on freedom of assembly and the racial justice movement here in the United States have even been met with federal efforts from law enforcement and from the Homeland Security officials who are now monitoring them and trying to essentially chill their ability to do their job. And so it's really created a tone that I would say moves far beyond just a chilling effect, that it's really something where many reporters are now, you know, risking their lives to be able to give people and communities credible information. And they're seeing attacks on every side, political, physical, digital.
That was Nora Benavidez, director of U.S. Free Expression Programs at the press freedom organization PEN America in New York. You are listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Hong Kong police arrested prominent democracy activist Joshua Wong Thursday. Reuters' Soraya Ali has that story.
Hong Kong police have arrested prominent democracy activist Joshua Wong for his involvement in last year's protests. He said authorities claimed his arrest was for participating in an unauthorized assembly in October 2019 and for violating the city's anti-mask law. The law, which is no longer in place, prevented people from wearing masks in public to help police identify protesters. 23-year-old Wong is the latest in a string of activists being charged after last year's pro-democracy protests. The unrest prompted Beijing to impose a sweeping national security law on June 30th. It punishes anything China considers as subversion, secession, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces, with up to life in prison. Speaking to the media after being released on bail, Wong had this to say.
So I urge the international community, instead of only focusing prominent activists just like me. I wish more people can pay attention to how 12 detainees are still being detained in Shenzhen and with the secret detention, which is totally violate on human rights. And it's time to urge the government stop the political prosecution. Chilling effect is not the way out, and it will not cause us to surrender.
His longtime colleague Agnes Chow and two other activists were among 10 people arrested in August on suspicion of violating the new law. Media tycoon Jimmy Lai was also detained weeks earlier on suspicion of colluding with foreign forces. Wong was just 17 years old when he became the face of the 2014 student-led umbrella movement democracy protests. But he was not a leading figure of the often violent unrest that shook Hong Kong last year. Wong has been a frequent visitor to Washington. He appealed to the U.S. Congress to support Hong Kong's democracy movement. His visits drew anger from Beijing, which says he is a backhand of foreign forces.
That was Reuters' Soraya Ali. South Korea's military says North Korea shot, killed, and cremated a South Korean civilian official who went missing earlier this week near the two countries' disputed Western Sea border. VOA's Bill Gallo has that story.
On Wednesday, South Korean officials announced a civilian working for the Ministry of Oceans and Fisheries disappeared near the sea border with North Korea. A day later, the grisly details began to emerge. Seoul's military says the man was found by North Korean officials at sea. They questioned him, shot him to death, doused his body with oil, and set him on fire, apparently all on orders from a superior.
우리 군은 북한의 이러한 만행을 강력히 규탄하고.
At a press briefing, South Korean General Ahn Young-ho said Seoul strongly condemns the atrocity and demands North Korea provide explanations and punish those responsible. The 47-year-old disappeared Monday while on duty aboard a patrol boat off the South Korean border island of Yeonpyeong. He was reported missing about 10 kilometers south of the de facto inter-Korean sea border. The circumstances of the man's disappearance are not clear. South Korean military officials believe he may have been trying to flee to North Korea. Local reports say he was struggling with debt and recently divorced. Inter-Korean border crossings are always dangerous, but even more so during the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. military says North Korea has issued shoot-to-kill orders to prevent the coronavirus from entering the country from China. Yang Mu-jin, a professor at the University of North Korean Studies in Seoul, says North Korea is locked down, almost as in a wartime situation, to prevent COVID-19 outbreaks. He says for now, resuming dialogue with North Korea is the most important thing. The shooting incident is awkwardly timed for South Korean President Moon Jae-in, who this week renewed his call for an end-of-war declaration with the North. The left-leaning Moon desperately wants to improve ties with Pyongyang before he leaves office in 2022. He's been trying to convince the North to return to the dialogue and cooperation that marked the beginning of his five-year term. The two countries have been in a technical state of war since their 1950s conflict ended in a truce and not a peace treaty. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
On Wednesday, the European Union unveiled new proposals to overhaul its migration policy. The plan calls for rapid screening of migrants in camps at Europe's borders and sending back people deemed not qualified for entry. For reaction to the proposals, journalist Catherine Field in Paris spoke to Michael Newman, a migration expert with the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, or MSF.
What effect will this or this whole new program have on an inducement for migrants to try and make it to Europe?
The actual migration policies supported by the EU member states can be summarized as deterrence. And I think that deterrence is still the key word of that pact, of the new framework that was presented yesterday. A lot of emphasis is put on sending migrants back to their states of and countries of origin. And for those who might have managed to cross and get to Europe, then there might be a bit more space to show a bit of humanity towards this population. But I think that by and large, Again, the key word is deterrence.
One of the proposals that has been put forward is that there will be a strengthening, as you say, of the external borders, but also there will be more screening facilities at the border. How can you see this 5-day screening at the external borders of the EU working, if indeed it can work at all?
Well, it's a good question, because what we've seen so far, for instance, in Greece or in Italy, has shown utter dysfunctioning of those identification procedures and all the administrative procedure related to asylum seeking. So if one looks only at the current practices, one can doubt highly of the possibilities that the EU member states can actually show more will to speed up the processes and make them functioning.
Are you expecting anything more to come from these proposals? And I'm thinking in particular of the EU actually doing more on the ground and supporting new enterprises in some of these countries where most of the migrants come from.
I mean, this is something that has been like a long promised commitment that the EU would help develop the countries of departure so that people would not be pushed to leave. You know, in the first steps of economic developments, people tend to move actually more. The other thing is that development is a long-term policy. It will not have an impact before years or decades. And I think that from a humanitarian perspective, what we are looking into is the consequences of current practices, right? And the current practices are obnoxious. I can't think of another word right now. When one looks at the situation of the hotspots in Moria who got burned, people being sent to another very hostile, quickly made camp on the same island, the situation in the Mediterranean Sea where all the NGO boats that manage, despite huge difficulties, to pursue their operations are systematically sequestered by the Italian authorities. People in Libya who are impeded to leave at all cost by the EU are actually the indicators of the current practices. I don't see anything in the pact that would go against that trend.
That was Mikhail Newman, a migration expert with the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, speaking to journalist Catherine Field in Paris. That's it for our show today. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Promoting economic growth in Latin America is especially important now as the region continues to combat COVID-19 and look towards a road to recovery, said U.S. Acting Assistant Secretary for Western Hemisphere Affairs, Ambassador Michael Kozak. The United States is a top trading partner for over two-thirds of the Western Hemisphere's countries. As the region's economies begin to reopen, the United States is doing its part to spur post-COVID economic growth through its Growth in the Americas, or America Crece, initiative. Countries of the region face a critical infrastructure gap, which limits economic growth. America Crece channels the resources and expertise of the U.S. government to attract private sector investment in energy, transportation, and telecommunications infrastructure across the region. To date, the United States has signed America Crece agreements with 10 partner countries: Panama, Chile, Jamaica, Argentina, Colombia, and more recently, El Salvador, Ecuador, Brazil, Honduras, and Bolivia. These agreements include commitments by the partner countries to strengthen competitiveness and transparency in line with international best practices. The U.S. International Development Finance Corporation, or DFC, is America's development bank and a critical tool in driving investment in support of America Crece. The United States expects the DFC to bring about at least $12 billion worth of investment in the region over the next 5 years. Another important player in revitalizing Western Hemisphere economies are international financial institutions, including the Inter-American Development Bank. Democracy is essential to building reliable infrastructure and a future of economic growth in the Americas. The COVID-19 pandemic has underscored the importance of secure supply chains with trusted partners. Countries, including the United States, stressed Ambassador Kozak, must reduce reliance on Chinese manufactured goods. That's why the United States is ramping up its efforts to strengthen and diversify U.S. supply chains and to rebuild hemispheric north-south supply chains. The goal is to move both sourcing and manufacturing closer to home. The United States will continue to be the partner of choice in helping the Western Hemisphere overcome the challenge of the COVID-19 pandemic. Meanwhile, growth, said Ambassador Kozak, remains the essential condition for cementing democratic institutions and completing the vision of a hemisphere of freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.